AI is not here to replace any real doctor, but instead it can help the real doctors to stay up to date with the current and the most recent medical research, and they can reduce their admin work, or they can increase their time of diagnosis and triaging by, I would say, maybe simpler diseases. So the real doctors can focus on doing more research, and they can invest their time in more complex diseases.
Welcome back to Stay Cognizant, the show where we explore how emerging technologies are reshaping business, government, and society, and how Cognizant is helping lead that transformation responsibly. I'm your host, Pamela Axtell, Senior Director of Global Brand Strategy and Marketing at Cognizant. Today, I'm joined by two of my colleagues who are working at the forefront of AI innovation. Sean Heshmat is Data and AI Head at Cognizant. He advises leaders across industries on how to embed AI at scale, with a focus on trust, governance, and real-world impact in sectors like healthcare and government. Sean, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you, Pamela.
I'm also joined today by Barak Gamush, an account director working with government clients across the Middle East, helping them implement AI in a way that meets regulatory, ethical, and operational demands. Welcome, Barak. Glad to have you here today.
Thanks, Pamela. Happy to be here. And I just want to happy to see you again.
So today we're going to be talking about a virtual clinician, how it was built, why it matters, and what it tells us about the future of AI in healthcare and in the public sector. So I'm going to start today with the big picture. Generative AI is already changing how we think about efficiency and productivity in just about every industry. And consumers are getting more and more used to interacting with bots and agents and other types of AI helpers. But today we're going to talk about using AI in healthcare, and specifically how AI can alleviate pressure on healthcare contact centers and on clinicians. I think it's safe to say that today's conversation will provide a glimpse into the future of telemedicine as we know it. So let's unpack the vision behind Cognizant's virtual clinician and talk a little bit about where AI in healthcare is heading. So Sean, I'm going to start with you. And I wonder if, just at a high level, share with us a little bit about what this virtual clinician is and what makes it different from other AI tools that are being explored in healthcare.
Thank you, Pamela. So the virtual clinician is what it says on the tin, so to speak. It is a virtual doctor, essentially. We were approached by a health authority in the Middle East where they wanted to add resiliency to their national non-emergency capabilities. Normally, it's a call center. Otherwise, you know, folks would call the general practitioner when they have an element. What they were wanting is essentially an experience that the patients would have that feels real. So we created a real life looking avatar that has the natural language processing capability, where the patient is able to interact and engage with that avatar. That avatar essentially was wired into a systems of AI that were designed to essentially understand and diagnose the particular ailment that patient is presenting to either the call center or to the GP. So in lieu of that. And the system was designed essentially in a fairly short period of time, where we trained actually 30 components, 30 different AIs to understand 30 different therapy areas. So the AI would understand what is the diagnosis of that particular patient by going through a series of questions, coming into a diagnosis, and based on that diagnosis and the severity of the perceived ailment, it would then arbitrage it to the most effective next steps. So obviously, if somebody's just having a bit of a headache, it would, you know, arbitrage them to a pharmacist. If it is more severe, then it would arbitrage them to a clinic or a hospital, and then it would suggest appointments in certain locations where the patient can actually book an appointment so they can be seen by a real human physician and then actually take them into the healthcare process from there on out. It's been proven very, very popular. We have thousands, over 5,000 different patient conversations. We're able to diagnose 918 individual conditions, many, many clinical pathways. To train the AI, we essentially trained it on over 15,000 peer-reviewed medical literature that was ingested to inform the diagnosis. And I think the most interesting part is the accuracy, which is around 98%, which is quite significant for an AI to achieve. And this is something that's been showcased in that particular country, have won multiple awards in many different regions. So it's something that's really pretty cool. We have a good white paper. If the audience would like to read more about it, I suggest they should get there, because there's a lot more details that I think will be interesting.
So many things to unpack there, and we'll get to a lot of my follow-up questions. But I want to ask Barak a question, which is, why did this concept resonate with public sector leaders specifically? What problem is this clinician solving that some of the more traditional health solutions haven't quite been able to, tackle?
Yeah, so thank you, Pamela, for the question. The public sector leaders in the region are looking forward to become the trendsetters and leaders in AI space, rather than following the trends of other regions and the globe. So this makes them open for innovation. And I think this tremendously helped the project, as it was aligned with their future strategies and ambitions. So as a matter of fact, they pushed us to do more in a short amount of time, as Sean mentioned. So I think the team behind the scenes did a tremendous job in making this idea into reality in a couple of months, with such levels of accuracy achieved. So I think this is a tremendous push coming from them. So it's really resonated well with them. And as Sean very well explained, I think I would just like to add a couple of points to that. What makes it so different, I believe, is that it is not just another fancy chatbot that gives you a predefined set of answers when it understands that you have a specific problem. But instead, it really interacts with you in a natural way, and it shows empathy as a real doctor would do. So when you ask and say, I have a headache, why would that be? It tells you, oh, I'm sorry to hear that. Is it a constant headache or is it coming and going? So I think this empathy is a great differentiator. But also it has a very solid decision tree in the background that works, and it works very fast. So it quickly understands and tries to eliminate other possibilities before coming up with a diagnosis and suggestions. So I think this is a great technical advantage that it has. But furthermore, I would like to add that it remembers the past conversations with a patient. So for instance, if someone has diabetes and the system knows that, and the person comes to the system the second time and says, I'm feeling dizzy today, it will ask, okay, I know you're diabetic. Did you check your blood sugar levels? So maybe you should check that first before we explore other options. So I think combined technology with empathy and natural flow of conversation, it's the real differentiator of the system that we have built here.
The question is, how do you build bedside manner? How do you give it that empathy and some of the qualities that are so important in a human clinician?
Yeah, so I think one of the parts, although I'm not going to touch on the technical details because I was not part of the technical team that built it. So when Sean is present, I think it is best that I leave it to him. But we use an interface that I believe gives it makes the people realize that it's not a real person. So it is not looking like a real person, but at the same time, it is giving the gestures and mimics to create that empathy and pass the feeling, I would say. But how did the technology do that in the background is something out of my knowledge area.
Yeah, and what we did, Barak and Pamela, is we used a lot of our knowledge in data science, and particularly natural language processing, not to to be empathetic, but to be appropriately empathetic, without sort of going over the top. So obviously, if somebody's in pain, it's a natural human instinct to say, "Well, I'm sorry that you feel this way." or when somebody, for example, had pain for a long time. You know, that sort of natural way that we speak, we trained our models to take certain cues without making it all about that. Because remember, what we're really trying to do is we're trying to have the 30 AIs built in to get into really what is the element that we're trying to diagnose. And essentially in the background, we had a central clinical governance model that is looking at the individual AIs that are trained in a particular therapeutic area, trying to come up essentially that, you know, the highest probabilistic sort of thinking in terms of what is it most likely to be. That was really the critical bit with that human niceties layered on top, because people are not used to engage with avatars. I mean, you may have this in a computer game, but to do this in something as concrete as health, the balance between you know, getting to the bottom of the problem, but doing this in a human way that the patient on the other end would feel better about engaging in details, and their answers would be detailed enough. So this clinician, which would be a GP, for example, if it's an equivalent GP, would understand and ask more questions until they're satisfied that they've got the element to the T, so they can recommend the arbitrage afterwards. That was the bit that kind of had the sympathy or empathy layered around it, but that was really the core of what we're also very proud of.
Amazing. Okay. So we've talked about the vision. Let's talk now a little bit more about what it takes to move from concept to something that you can actually roll out and, you know, have people use in a clinical grade way, and how you design for impact when the stakes are high, right? You know, healthcare is not just a heavily regulated industry. It's an industry where people are putting their trust of their health, you know, into the hands of a tool like this. And, you know, Sean, you talked about the accuracy. You know, it's got 98% accuracy with over 900 conditions, which is, you know, pretty impressive. It's almost like you're sending it to a mini medical school. But what's the downstream impact in terms of healthcare delivery when you've got something like this clinician that now you can take a portion of work that either telemedicine or clinicians would be doing and presumably redeploy their talents and skills in another area? What's the downstream impact of a tool like this?
I mean, for me, it's, you know, the problem statement was resiliency. How can I add resiliency to my, you know, non-emergency capabilities, i.e. either it's face-to-face with the GP or call center, et cetera. I think this particular capability would really add a lot of resilience to any national health ecosystem, simply because it's not like you can call, say, from 8 to 8 or 8 to 5. You can call anytime, so you have essentially 24/7 access. You have complete auditability of that conversation and a complete transparency and explainability of why certain diagnoses and certain arbitraging happen. So you're able to do this, obviously, at a fairly, you know, modest cost, because it's just the cost of the setup and the cost of operations. So the additional resiliency whereby you're able to access medical care when you want to. And for example, I'm based in the UK and we have something called the 8 a.m. rush. When you call a general practitioner and all the appointments are booked, and then you call this other number 111, and then obviously there's maybe an hour or 45 minute delay. This is concrete medical advice and arbitraging when you need it and when you're available to engage, rather than the other way around. I think this is, you know, definitely a pivot point for us as we engage or as the healthcare systems engage with us population that need medical assistance.
So building on that notion of a pivot point, Barak, when you bring a solution like this to a public sector client, what shifts for them? You know, I assume this was delivered as a proof of concept, but I imagine they're looking at this as a new standard for how they scale access and treatment across all of their populations. Talk a little bit about, you know, how they're seeing this clinician fitting into their vision for healthcare delivery.
Yeah, thanks, Pamela. So I wouldn't just limit it to the healthcare, if I may. So I believe If I look at the region and the public sector and public services, there is no doubt that, as I mentioned in my previous response, that they want to be the number one digital and AI governments globally. So the citizen and resident interaction with the government here is at the next level. So to become the number one and to reach their goals, the governments are not afraid of trying fast and failing fast if this is what it takes to reach there. And I think this is giving them a unique ability to scale fast. And when we bring them an idea, at first, of course, they want to assess if it's a reliable idea that can really improve the everyday life of citizens. So they are keen on seeing a POC first so they can see the idea in motion. But if it's a good idea, they are really receptive. So if it is going to help them reach their targets to become number one, they are really receptive and they are really fast in making decisions. And just to give a bit of a context for people who are not familiar with the region here, Dubai has launched an initiative that is called Smart Dubai, which aims to become a number one, the most hippiest city on earth. So Dubai's aim is to become the most hippiest city in the world. And I live in Dubai over the last 8 years, and I have seen a tremendous shift. And I am using the digital technologies, integrated systems. I'm interacting with AI to do daily tasks. And I am seeing tremendous incentive behind this. So the public sector here in the region is very receptive of great ideas and innovation.
That's really so interesting, because one of the things that I wondered, and Sean, maybe you can talk about this a little bit, is trust. You know, when you build something like this, and you talked earlier about the fact that because it's got, you know, a clinical governance layer, and because of the way it was designed, it's much more than just a chatbot. It's something that has more of a real feeling, while people also realize it's not human. But how does the way that we built this make it more easily trustable for citizens, for patients, for clinicians? But also, you know, I think it's interesting what Barak just said. It sounds like there's a lower barrier for trust generally, perhaps, in a place like Dubai, where you may be used to using AI in ways that people in other parts of the world are not. So how would you think about translating that to other places? Like if you brought this to the UK, if you brought this to the US, where there may be less exposure to using technology in this way, how does that trust piece, you know, how do you tackle that?
Well, I think you have to provide evidence that you are engaging with a person in a responsible manner. And this is really where, you know, responsible AI becomes really critical enabler for the adoption of this. That is, you know, the patients in this case, or, you know, other stakeholders need to make sure that, you know, that you build in fairness mechanisms, you build in reliability, it's safe to use, your information is not going to get leaked, it's GDPR compliance is very big, so privacy, it is secure, it's inclusive. The conversation is transparent in terms of why the AI recommended this, and you can actually audit that. That becomes really, really important. Ultimately, the AI is a channel for this particular virtual clinician, and somebody has to be accountable. A real human being has to be accountable for the success, or if there are challenges, a human being has to own up. You cannot blame the machine. I think we have a little bit ways to go to embody the responsible AI thinking in all of the AI products that we put out there. I do think the relationship between humans and machines, you know, would evolve, whereby you'll be able to engage with these tools if you feel they're responsible. And if you feel they're responsible, and as you engage with them, that that feeling of trust and value comes in, then people would be willing to share more details to get more insight about what is the element, what's the condition. But again, the core of this is entities, healthcare entities, corporate need to really take responsible AI seriously and really disseminate that throughout their AI products and have a good governance board, because trust is difficult to gain from the consumer and very easy to lose. So that's something that definitely, you know, we should be looking out for.
I want to dive a little bit more into some of the data, you know, and what we're seeing in terms of sentiment. And, you know, last year, the Harris poll in the United States, you know, almost 60% of US-based adults believe that AI-assisted diagnosis and treatment will significantly improve health outcomes within the next decade. 57% believe it could reduce healthcare costs. I'm guessing, Sean, those numbers track with your experience. And, you know, at the same time, there's a lot of optimism there. There's some lingering skepticism. I think you've already talked about what that means to design at scale, that, you know, you've got to build that trust into the model. But what else in terms of, like, when you think about going into, again, markets like the United States, where there's not such broad, you know, reach of innovation and technology across the country, what are some of the other things you have to think about in terms of how you roll out a product or a solution like this?
So what we have as a virtual clinician is a very visible AI. There are other AI interventions that are not so visible that are using responsible AI principles to get better at really understanding the diseases. So, for example, with Alzheimer or cancer, you know, an AI that, you know, being developed is able to combine the images from an MRI scan, really take the audio tapes from a speech to make sure that they are, you know, kind of bringing in any sort of anomalies in that speech that may make us think that there might be an early form of Alzheimer, taking some of the genetic data to see if they are predisposed with certain markers, using those and, you know, as a way to improve diagnostic accuracy. Same for cancer, right? You know, it's not just about the tumor. It's also about the issues around the tumors. It's also about the genomics. So there's a number of AI capabilities that are able to work in the background to improve, for example, the accuracy and the diagnosis of certain diseases. And it goes across different therapeutic areas. So I think this is also the exciting part. It's not just the avatar having a human-like conversation and 98% accuracy of diagnosing and then arbitraging when you have the time and when you want to engage. It's also what's happening behind the scenes to allow the clinicians to improve their diagnosis and overall expand our knowledge of particular diseases and their pathways.
So we've talked, you know, a little bit about, you know, the public and patients, but, you know, on the healthcare side, leaders within healthcare are also, you know, ready to move and really thinking about the efficiencies that they can gain from AI. There was a Wolters Kluwer Future Ready Healthcare Survey this year that, you know, shows a lot of enthusiasm for things like prior authorizations, improving electronic health record workflows, which we know are very burdensome for clinicians. You know, they see the value in telehealth. Brock, I'm wondering, you know, what other areas, though, could you see this moving into? And especially, you know, I know when we're talking about the current version of the AI clinician, we're talking about non-emergency health. Do you think there's a future where something like this will be able to do even more? And also, I guess my second related question is, we've seen in a lot of other industries that leaders talk about using AI, not, you know, the efficiencies that they gain in one area, they're using to reinvest into new innovation in another area. So can you also see, Barack, you know, is there enthusiasm for that as well? And maybe using AI to come up with net new ideas about how healthcare is provided?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think this is the public sector and the healthcare industries are looking at AI very, very optimistically, and they take it as a positive. And of course, I mean, if you look at the internet of the time that when it first was open to public, we saw some barriers at first, because I think the human beings are resistant to change, so it doesn't come overnight. But if you look at the acceleration of the innovation that internet brought to our lives, how quickly we adopted it, and then how many new things we generated by this new power that we had, I think is a great example of the recent history that can show us what we can do beyond our imagination today with AI in the future. So to your first question, Pamela, I believe definitely we will see more capabilities added to this AI as we train the systems, as we increase the public opinion on the accuracy, the transparency, the responsible AI part of it, as Sean mentioned. I think once this is embraced by the public, we will see it being used more broadly for more complex diseases and diagnosis. But I believe today, where I see the biggest barrier is probably the cultural one, because I believe the general opinion that people might have is, what if AI is going to steal our jobs away from us? So in our case of the virtual clinician here, in the contrary, AI is not here to replace any real doctor, but instead it can help the real doctors to stay up to date with the current and the most recent medical research, and they can reduce their admin work, or they can increase their time of diagnosis and triaging by, I would say, maybe simpler diseases. So the real doctors can focus on doing more research, and they can invest their time in more complex diseases. So I think this is answering the second part of your question, that with this new time capital, I would say, that we have in our hands, thanks to the support of AI, I think we can focus on bigger problems, and we can extend the support of AI as it evolves over time.
So it's a partnership, really, isn't it, between AI and clinicians? It's not about one taking over the other. It's about how they make each other better. So I want to shift gears a little bit and talk about what drives both of you, what keeps you focused, what keeps you hopeful. Sean, I'm going to start with you. And I wonder if you could think a little bit, you know, your work cuts across industries, across geographies. What's the most important sort of mindset shift that you think leaders need to make to successfully adopt AI in the public sector?
I think you alluded to this earlier, Pamela, which is basically trust. The public sector in general is sitting on mountains of data that is sitting in different agencies, different departments, different ministries. The experience of the citizen or the taxpayer is not that great, because you deal with different silos, which is kind of the public sector. Each bit of the public sector does not recognize your engagement with the other parts. Part of this, of course, is the data privacy regulation and the lack of consent from the citizens to provide that data to be integrated in a way that helps public sector to provision services faster, more cost effectively, in a way that, again, engendered trust. So part of this is, first of all, obviously focus on the amazing evolution of technologies and what they're able to afford to us that we did not have before, but really focus on your data, which is your foundation, how you're sharing it, how you're being compliant, how you're using it responsibly, as we talked about, and then really build org structures around activating all of this, and then proving to the citizens that they can trust you handling their data by you provisioning these services, information, whatever you require, at a point that is efficient, that is fast, it's accurate, it's transparent. I think tech is going to be very, very important, but also how the public sector leaders engage with their fellow citizens to make sure that it's not just tech for tech's sake, but it's actually providing really differentiated services and getting that trust from the citizens by using the data responsibly and then layering the AI responsibly and making sure that the citizens see the value in doing that. That is one thing that we definitely advise our public sector clients to think through, and how you can integrate a lot of that data together in a responsible, fair, and transparent way. And then have your added-on services to be that much more improved because you're able to do that.
Barak, what makes transformation in the public sector difficult, but also very necessary?
So I believe this is a really good question, Pamela, and thank you for asking that. I would like to first address, why is it so necessary to transform the public sector? And I would like to start by saying that public sector is the powerhouse behind innovation, because they can create the right regulatory environment, and they can also provide incentives to support the private sector initiatives. So in return, this will accelerate innovation, and it will increase citizen engagement, satisfaction, and also overall quality of life. So I believe this is why it is so essential that we start the transformation with the public sector. So this is the second half of your question. And to come to the first half, at the same time, transforming public sector can be difficult because of the regulatory complexities that it has, because of the scale that we are talking about when it comes to the public sector and the number of agencies and ministries, as Sean mentioned, and also the impact it has on the local and at the global level. So it cannot be isolated. It is very well connected with the rest of the world. This is why I believe that the public sector leaders of today are trying to make sure that they are selecting and investing in the right technologies, but equally, or maybe more importantly, they want to make sure that they are working with the right partners who they can trust and who knows responsible and fair AI to help them transform their public sector services. So I think this is the key.
So, you know, when I first read about this solution, I was extremely intrigued by it because it takes two areas, public sector and healthcare, that we really tend to think of as laggards for all sorts of reasons, right? There's a lot of legacy, you know, infrastructure, there are legacy attitudes, you know, there are a lot of hurdles to overcome. I wonder for each of you, you know, what is exciting? Do you share the same sort of, you know, excitement about a project like this? And, you know, what are some of the most sort of confidence building or exciting aspects of working on something like this virtual AI clinician?
For me, Pamela, I mean, one of the things I've been very passionate about is this, you know, human machine collaboration, because obviously, you know, with the our ability to use a lot more processing power, a lot of decisions that we use to try to build in from a kind of a data science perspective, where a lot of the effort used to be in terms of getting the data, training the model, you know, doing multiple things. With our ability now, with the LLMs coming, that's been trained on large volumes of data, our job in the enterprise becomes a little bit easier and enables us to do things that was not possible in the past. One of my passions is, you know, the digital twins, basically creating kind of virtual replicas of the enterprise as the real version is running, and being able to kind of have a situation room in terms of predicting certain things and taking actions that are recommendations that potentially may be suggested by a machine, but QA'd and approved or rejected by a human being. Making us more productive, making us more efficient, making us do more things but at a human pace, making us do things that we human enjoy. Like, for example, talking to you today, you know, having conversations, getting into a meeting, brainstorming, and then having machines do some of the things that requires a lot more processing. The combination for me between, you know, the AI or the machines and us are very powerful together. It's not that or that. It's both combined together. And we see a lot of these things, for example, when you use Copilot. You know, Copilot is not writing things for you. Well, you could, you know, essentially just let it do. But most people, what they do is they get the ideas and then they edit it themselves and they personalize it and then they make it. And that maybe saves them some time and gives them some ideas that maybe was in the back of their head. But once they saw it in the text, they kind of took it, you know, a little bit more seriously. For me, productivity via better collaboration between machines and humans, with humans being in control in the loop, is something that I tend to gravitate towards, and is something that a lot of our programs and projects really has as their core. So that's, you know, for me, I feel very lucky. I'm in a very exciting area and I do this for a living. So, you know, I'm very lucky and very fortunate.
So to echo what Sean was saying, of course, these are all the points that I couldn't agree more. But also, when it comes specific to the public sector, I mean, make it AI or any different service that we are providing to our clients, in the end, I think the most satisfaction for me is that we are touching the lives of citizens and people. So as a citizen or resident myself, I'm also using some of those services. My friends and family and my coworkers, my colleagues are using some of those services. And you can see a real impact in your daily life of something that you are doing in the background. And people don't have to know that it is you or your team or your company, but you see the real impact. And I think seeing this improvement in everyday life is what keeps me going in the public sector area.
So when it comes to AI in healthcare and the public sector, not all use cases are created equal. Some, like the virtual AI clinician we've been talking about today, drive real change. We have an Innovation Hall of Fame, something we talk about on every episode. And Sean and Brock, I'd love to get your takes. Sean, is there a solution, one you've worked on or one you've observed, that you think belongs in the Hall of Fame for truly moving the needle in healthcare or in the public sector?
I think in the healthcare sector, what I'm really fascinated with is the evolution of solutions. For example, about 7-8 years ago, we proved that machines that can diagnose oncology scans are able to diagnose the occurrence of a tumor a little bit better than a trained oncologist. However, the oncologist and radiology AI together can do a lot better. What I find it really amazing is the evolution of solutions like that, where we're trying to actually augment other conditions, as I said before, whether it's speech, whether it's genetics, whether it is other markers, and being able to do even a better job of actually not just understanding, for example, a tumor, and it is, likelihood of, increasing. The way that we are actually improving our older models by putting agentic and generative AI on top, for me, that is really exciting. And I must admit, I don't have a single instance, but I just feel fascinated with taking some really good, robust models that we did in the past, improving it even more with adding some of the new technology capabilities that we have in the AI world, and putting that to the public use and seeing the results, as it goes. So that's a bit that I'm really excited about, and that's a bit that, in my mind, there's about dozens of these, from digital twins to tumor detections, and overall creating a better diagnosis and a therapy pathway to make the patients be healthier than what we would have done, say, 5 or 6 years ago.
Brock, same question for you. What's a recent use case you've seen that really stands out? And maybe even, if you focus on public sector, offers some good thoughts and lessons for others trying to make AI work in the public sector?
Yeah, absolutely. So, of course, I would say number one is the virtual clinician, but of course, this is the highlight of the show. So apart from that, I would like to give two significant ideas that we have been working on recently. Although they are not productionized yet, I think the conversations are going in the right direction. So they are from two different countries in the region, two different government organizations. First one is with the government entity. And this government entity has invested significantly in their infrastructure. So they increased their public transportation systems, and they added more bus lines, they added more buses to the system. So they have made some significant improvements there. And on each and every single bus, they have a bus-mounted camera, so they can record the incidents, and they have the recordings available to them. So the idea of that was, what if we feed this data, images, videos to the AI, so that the AI can scan the roads and it can identify any potholes, any cracks, any road defects, so it can improve proactive maintenance, reduce costs, and provide a better environment for the citizens. So I think this is a real real impact scenario. And the second one is with a local government authority. So for a specific service, the applicants, the citizens, must submit their documents through a portal. They must log in, they must submit their documents. And on the other hand of the portal, there are admins who are looking at these documents, which can be in different formats, such as invoices, birth certificates, ID cards, or court decisions. And predominantly they are in Arabic language, but they can be multiple languages. So the admins take all these documents, which can be tens or hundreds of pages in some complex cases, And they have to read through them to make sure that the applicant is eligible for the service. And this is not a straightforward service. So, of course, this human interaction part was creating a sort of a bottleneck for the client. And this was creating some dissatisfaction with the citizens. And we actually did a POC demo for them. So instead of spending days on identifying the documents, understanding what's in it, the AI vision can maybe in seconds or minutes scan these documents, give the admin the relevant information, and if needed, it can show the reference of where this information coming from to the admin so that the humans can use this superpower they have, and then they can go to the document, they can make analysis, and they can improve the processing times at a great scale. So after all these ideas we exchanged with the public sector clients, I would like to add one thing here that I learned. I believe finding the ideas that solves real-world problems and improves everyday life is a key to make AI work with the public sector clients.
That is a great summary. So as we heard today, AI's impact on the public sector and healthcare depends not just on what the technology can do, but on how it's built, deployed, and governed. At Cognizant, that means leading with trust, designing for impact, and really working hand in hand with our clients to turn emerging tools like AI into real-world outcomes. Sean and Barak, thank you so much for being here today. I am a huge fan of the work you're doing with the virtual AI clinician, and I really appreciate you joining the show today and sharing a little bit more about this solution. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Pamela. I really enjoyed our conversation. Thank you, Barak, very much also for the great responses.
Thank you, Pamela, for having us today. It's been a pleasure. And thank you, Sean. It's been great.
And thanks to all of you for listening. We'll be back soon with more on how Cognizant is helping organizations turn emerging technologies into meaningful progress. We'll see you next time on Stay Cognizant.